Well, I'm really delighted to be here with you all. As most of you probably know, my name is Joseph. It's great to see so many of you in this fantastically beautiful place. I'll just do a quick introduction. I think you know all of my teaching colleagues for the retreat, but Linda McDonald is the executive director in Vancouver of West Coast Dharma. She's a psychotherapist. She teaches in Vancouver and around the West Coast. Rodney Smith is the founding father of SIMS, which is, as most of you know, really a fantastic development in the Dharma in the Northwest. He's also a guiding teacher of the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. And he very heroically makes the jaunt across the country a few times a year to the board meetings, which we're appreciative of. And Heather Martin is the guiding teacher at Salt Spring Island, and she also teaches all up and down the West Coast. So this is the team. So tonight I'd like to give just a little framework for the retreat. It's going to be a little different than perhaps past retreats you've been on in terms of instructions and emphasis. Basically, meditation, as you know, is an investigation of who we are. It's a systematic way of understanding and exploring from the inside the nature of our bodies, the nature of thought, the nature of emotion, the nature of awareness itself. Really addresses the very mysterious question, what is consciousness? And how can we understand it? Meditation is the careful discipline of paying attention to our own inner process. So the insight that comes is intuitive. It's not conceptual. It's not intellectual. It's coming out of our own experience. And we come to understand in this very direct way the forces in the world and in ourselves which cause suffering, and the forces in the world and in ourselves which are the cause of happiness and peace. What's been very interesting over these last 30 or 35 years, as the Dharma has really flourished in the West, is that there have been so many different traditions, different Buddhist traditions, coming to the West, flourishing in the West. And so there are these many different traditions and different methods and even different metaphysics, different ways of explaining experience. And sometimes it can get confusing. You know, one of the interesting things about Western practitioners is that for many people, we find ourselves exposed to this wide range of Dharma offerings. Sometimes the teachings are even contradictory. You know, I've studied with teachers who I considered really great enlightened masters say opposite things about the nature of reality, the nature of freedom. Some teachers speak of a pure awareness as being the nature of the free mind. And somehow we need to come to recognize it. Some teachers say that freedom transcends even awareness. Well, that could put one's mind on tilt. You know, how do we hold these different views? And for a long time, I was plagued with the question, who's right? You know, and just that way of framing the question was a problem. Because if someone is right, then someone else is wrong. So I struggled with this for quite a while as I myself was exposed to different traditions and different teachers and different methods how to resolve this basic question. Then there came a moment when it all did resolve, and it was tremendously helpful for me. And this was the understanding that all the teachings and even all the different metaphysics, you know, describing reality are not statements of ultimate truth, but rather they are all skillful means for freeing the mind. If we take teachings to be statements of truth, then opposing statements create a problem. If we take all teachings as being a skillful means for freeing us from suffering, then it's fine to have different views and different methods and different metaphysics. The question then becomes not who's right, but does it work? Does it help us? That understanding, that transformation of framing the question really allowed me then to open up to this wide range of teachings and to really see what was useful, what was helpful. No matter what concepts we use, it's important to understand that concepts are always limited. In their very nature, they're limited. And so we need to use the concepts, use the words, hear the teachings, but not be caught by them. And actually use them as pointers, as skillful means, to look at our direct experience. So the question then is, what is truly skillful? And if we hear all the teachings as being skillful means, what is skillful? What is the essence of a free mind? Now, the Buddha expressed this very clearly and very frequently. So he laid it out for us in a very straightforward way. He said, this is the deathless, namely, liberation through non-clinging. Liberation through non-clinging. He said, the supreme state of sublime peace has been discovered by the Tathagata, which is how he referred to himself, namely liberation through non-clinging. Centuries later in India, the great Indian tantric adept, Talopa, expressed this same truth to his disciple, Naropa, who then passed it on to Marpa and Milarepa and the source of one of the great Tibetan lineages. He said, you are not fettered by appearances. You are fettered by attachments. So cut your attachments. It's the same message. Cut your attachments. Liberation through non-clinging. Now, we've all had some experience of this. And we've all had a taste of this, which is really what brings us all here together to practice. The more we pay attention, it becomes so obvious directly that every time we get caught up in something, every time we get lost in, identified with, cling to something, whether it's an attachment, a judgment, an aversion, expectation, wanting, fear, doubt, whatever it may be that we get caught up in, and cling to and identified with, in that moment of clinging, we can feel, if we're paying attention, the contraction in the heart. It's like things tighten. So one way of practicing liberation through non-clinging is learning through practice to relax the heart. You know, and just to remember that in Buddhist terminology and in many Buddhist languages, the word for heart and mind is the same. You know, they have one word, whereas we make it into two. So when you hear the word heart or you hear the word mind, think both, right? The heart-mind. What we're practicing is relaxing, opening this heart-mind moment after moment, again and again, which allows then for the natural openness the natural awareness of mind to manifest. One of the great realizations for us, and I think this is part of the maturing of a spiritual practice, is to realize that this relaxing of the heart, this opening, this letting go, is not something to think of as a far-off goal. You know, well, we'll practice for 20 years, 30 years, and maybe someday my heart will open. This is our practice in the moment. This is actually what we're practicing moment after moment. It's important to see it in this way. So during this retreat, we're going to be exploring different ways of relaxing the heart and recognizing this open mind, open heart mind of non-grasping, of non-clinging. The first couple of days, we'll be practicing the very explicit instructions the Buddha gave in the Satipatthana Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. Now, most of you know that's the sutta or discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. So it is the key discourse for all of our practice. For the past few years, I've been teaching 2 or 3 months a year at the Forest Refuge at IMS in Barrie. And a few years ago, inspired by one particular book by a German monk called Venerable Amalayo, which is called Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. It's a wonderful book, and I read it, and it re-engaged my interest in this discourse. So I started giving a series of talks. Now, this has been going on for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, just on this one discourse, going through it very carefully, line by line. So now there are like, I don't know, 38 or 39 talks just on this discourse. I learned a lot by doing this. And I realized that although I've been practicing Vipassana for more than 40 years now, there were some steps that the Buddha described in the discourse that I had just skipped over. So that was a little startling. And then as I was giving the talks on them and really looking at the steps, I thought, well, maybe I should actually practice it. And lo and behold, it was very helpful. So what I'd like to do, especially these first few days, is to go through that with you. It's very simple. This is not complicated. But there are some aspects to working with the breath in the way the Buddha outlined that I found very opening and onward leading. And so we'll begin the instructions, particularly tomorrow morning, and just go through these steps very carefully. It may help you, and as it helped me, just to learn some new skills with a very familiar object, the breath, just to learn some new skills in terms of balancing the mind in calm, in concentration, in allowing the mind to settle. Then, with this as the basis, so we'll spend a couple of days doing this, then we'll engage the mind in this practice of freedom, but from a somewhat different perspective. So we'll use the basis, you know, of that calm and concentration on the breath, and then begin to investigate the nature of the mind in a way that was expressed very beautifully by a 12th century Korean Zen master whose name was Shinul. And he was one of the founders of Korean Zen. And his teaching is found in a book called Tracing Back the Radiance, which is a beautiful title and a beautiful book. And he framed his teachings with a very interesting notion. He framed all of his teachings as sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. So he begins with awakening. He begins with the recognition of the awakened mind, but then emphasizes the gradual cultivation that fully actualizes that potential. And I've always appreciated this particular formulation because it explicitly acknowledges the union in practice of both the ultimate and the relative levels of truth. The ultimate level we could call sudden awakening, where we understand everything, all experience, to be insubstantial, to be empty of self. As the great Thai master Ajahn Buddhadasa said, from this perspective, there's nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to have. You could go home. Nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to have. Everything's already accomplished. However, to simply say that everything is empty and that there's nothing to do without a full and complete realization of it can really lead us to a kind of nihilism, you know, a disengagement with the world and with our own inner processes. Oh yeah, everything's empty, it doesn't matter. Well, that can come from two very different places. It can come from an awakened mind, and it can come from delusion. On the other hand, even though we recognize the need for this gradual cultivation, so we're not just, you know, being in a deluded state of, oh, everything's empty, without fully realizing it, still, this ultimate level, the level of sudden awakening, even if it's momentary, even if we just have sudden moments of recognition, of understanding the empty nature of awareness, this helps us not be lost or not be so caught in the endless struggle with the defilements in the mind, as we can so often be. You know, for many of us, our practice sometimes, at least, feels like we're just in a struggle with the hindrances. You know, and we reify them as being something substantial, and we invest in them as some expression of self, of I. And so we're creating this huge burden for ourselves because we're not seeing their empty nature. So this is why this formulation for me just encompasses both aspects: sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. We can see the emptiness, the selflessness of phenomena, and at the same time realizing, yes, this needs to be cultivated. There's one exchange between a Chinese Zen master, and I'm not sure of this pronunciation, Shitao. It's spelled S-H-I-T-O-U. So if somebody knows Chinese and wants to let me know the correct pronunciation. But for now, there's this exchange between this Zen master Shitao and some disciple, a seeker of the truth. And this little exchange, it just highlights a bit what I feel will be the theme of the retreat, or some aspect of what we're doing here together. So this seeker came to the Zen master and said, "What am I supposed to do?" And Shitao replies, probably not with a Jewish accent, "Why are you asking me?" I can just hear it. Why are you asking me? What am I supposed to do? Why are you asking me? So the student says, where else can I find what I'm looking for? And Shi Tao says, are you sure you lost it? So we all come to the practice really with some form of this question, what am I supposed to do? Just to be here, the effort that you needed to make on so many levels, just kind of leaving family and friends, just the ease and comfort of being at home, the difficulty of getting here, the time to get here, the money for the retreat. There was a lot of effort that you all made to be here for this week. So the question, now what should I do, really seems appropriate. Okay, you made this effort. What now? But Shi Tao was not seduced by the question. And he just turned the question back. Why are you asking me? But then we think, well, of course I'm asking you. How else can I find what I'm looking for? It seems so obvious that we would be asking Shi Tao if we met him. But then he strikes, as Zen masters are wont to do. How else can I find what I'm looking for? Are you sure you lost it? So that's a profound turning back. That response challenges us. So this week we're going to be exploring exactly what it is we're looking for and whether or not we have indeed ever lost it. This is the work of the week. So as a kind of preview, of this exploration, there are a few very direct teachings that point to this empty, aware nature of mind. And just these are little teasers, for what we can begin to explore together. Perhaps some of you are familiar with the writings of Wei Wu Wei, who was actually, I think he was Irish or English, I'm not sure, but he lived in Hong Kong for many years, and he really had some kind of awakening experiences, because his books are just filled with quite profound Dharma wisdom. But they're often in the form of these little aphorisms. And one of them, which I found particularly helpful, and you might remind yourself at times when you're struggling, he said, what we're looking for is what is looking. And again, it's just that turning back. We're so busy looking for something that we don't realize that what we're looking for is what is looking. The heart relaxes. So Shanul, he said, the nature of the mind, the nature of awareness, is unstained and is originally whole and complete in itself. So that's a good reminder. If we're feeling unworthy in some way or incomplete in some way, it's not. The nature of the mind is unstained and is originally, from the beginning, whole and complete in itself. So it's not about becoming something. It's about recognizing. And this is from the Tibetan tradition. The essence of mind is like space. Therefore, there is nothing it does not encompass. So all of these are like pointers to us. Buddhadasa, the great Thai master of the last century, said we should really call mind emptiness, but because of awareness, we call it mind. So there's this just understanding of the nature of the mind, the empty nature of it, and yet it has a cognizing nature. It has a cognizing function. So can we learn about this? This is not something outside of ourselves. This is the nature of our minds. So can we develop the tools, you know, through disciplined practice? Can we really develop the tools to understand this for ourselves? As we start the retreat, there are just some basic guidelines, most of which are very familiar to you, you know, and suggestions that will help you in the transition from the busyness of your life and all the traveling into this retreat space of silence, of stillness, and of course here at Hollyhock, into this space of extraordinary natural beauty. We enter a space here where there are few distractions, you know, few diversions, where there's a tremendous immediacy of experience. That's the power of a retreat, you know, where we really come face to face with ourselves. Now, part of the space that we're creating here comes from one very powerful but unpopular commitment. It's usually unpopular. And that is the spirit of renunciation. You know, so much of the Buddha's teaching is about renunciation, but not renunciation as a burden, but renunciation as being the freedom that comes from letting go. So even though we're in this very beautiful venue that offers many delightful opportunities in body work, in hot tubs, and the like, keep in mind that for this week, we are really creating a temporary monastery. You know, and that's a rare thing in this world. Just together, through the precepts and the refuges that Heather will be offering just in a few minutes, we're creating a monastery, and the power of a monastery through the ages has come through the power of renunciation, where we practice restraint of the senses rather than sense pleasures. You know, we practice letting go rather than getting. And this is going to be particularly challenging at mealtime, when the food here is delicious. Just having had that fantastic dinner, which we all had, and reflecting for myself, your practice will be well served by moderation. It will be hard. It's so inviting and so delicious. Be aware. Just be aware of how you feel. You know, be moderate in the food. So this is all part of just the spirit of renunciation. It's a tremendous support for yourself, of course, and will be a support for your fellow yogis. One of the most beautiful aspects of the retreat, and I think most of you are very familiar with this, it's one of the most beautiful and healing aspects, is the silence. It is such a relief not to have to present oneself to anybody. You know, it's just the silence provides that space where we can settle back into ourselves. We don't have to be anybody for anybody else. It's quite amazing to be in silence with 100 fellow practitioners. And this is a very rare event in the world. You know, Rumi, expressed it really well. He said, which is worth more, a crowd of thousands or your own genuine solitude? Freedom or power over an entire nation? Which is worth more? A little time alone will prove more valuable than anything that could ever be given you. Yeah, and I think most of you are experienced practitioners. We all know this. You know, it is such an amazingly rare and precious gift that you've given to yourselves. So enjoy the silence, settle into the silence, respect the silence, you know, because it is so beautiful. Something else that will be really helpful and that you'll need to really learn how to use skillfully is slowing down. Now, as was mentioned, it doesn't mean necessarily that you're always creeping along at super slow pace, because sometimes that will be fine. You know, if you're doing walking meditation and you're just kind of dropped in and you're kind of in that very microscopic, subtle level of feeling the movement, it's great. When there are 95 people behind you trying to get something done, it's not so great. So pay attention. But generally, slowing down from our normal pace will really help. It helps us to settle back, to be more attentive. One very useful feedback, you know, energetic feedback, is the feeling of rushing. Just notice when you're rushing. And what's interesting that I found, we can rush at any speed. You know, we normally think of rushing as moving quickly. I've seen myself rush moving very slowly, especially when the lunch bell rings. You know, especially at IMS where it's not so long distances, I could be moving really slowly, but there is a toppling forward. It's like energetically, I'm ahead of myself. Right? So pay attention to that energetic balance at whatever speed you're walking. And that depends on the situation. Are you settled back in yourself, settled back in your body, really present for the movement, for what you're doing, or is that feeling of rushing? Is there that feeling of toppling forward? It is a very useful feedback. And it just reminds us, okay, settle back. Take time for the small things. You know, closing doors, brushing your teeth, putting your shoes on. Just all the little things we do all day. The gift of the retreat is that you have nothing else to do except to be aware. That's your yogi job. Awareness. So it's wonderful if you just settle and drop into that space and make the day as seamless as possible at different speeds, depending on what has to be done, but really with that commitment to practice the seamlessness. There'll be times when the mind forgets and we get lost. That's going to happen. But always coming back with that intention. Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, the great artist, had a wonderful little statement. She said, still, in a way, nobody sees a flower, really. It is so small. We haven't time. And to see takes time. Like to have a friend takes time. And I love that because you know what it's like when you come upon maybe a flower or you see something in nature and you actually take the time to look. It's like something that we may have passed by a million times and didn't see, and all of a sudden there's a world. to see takes time, like to have a friend takes time. Can we make a friend of our own experience? Can we make a friend of each breath, of each sensation, of sights and sounds? Right? So we take time. We're just there for it as the world presents itself to us. Sometimes people equate silence and caring attention with being grim. Awareness and grimness are two completely different things. So just keep that in mind. Grimness has nothing to do with this. The silence, the slowing down, the caring attention. I don't know, the whole week can be just a graceful movement through the day. And there'll be bumps. There'll definitely be bumps, and we're going to be talking about the bumps as well. But it's just that sense of relaxing into it all. In mindfulness, in awareness, there are the qualities of openness, the qualities of appreciation, the quality of interest in what's happening. It's really the deep willingness, and we could even say the passion, to know ourselves, to understand our minds and our hearts. There was a Japanese poet, Izumi, and she expressed this really well. And again, she's, I think, 11th century. She said, "The moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky." Okay, so just get the picture, but just imagine her, either outside or at the window. The moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky. I knew myself completely, no part left out. And I just couldn't recognize that moment of just the recognition of allowing ourselves to know ourselves completely, no part left out. So that's our practice. That's what we're going to be doing together for this week. And all of this, everything I said and all of our practice can be held in the context of a really great and noble aspiration that all of our efforts and all of our practice is not just for ourselves alone, but we can dedicate it not only dedicated, but actually put the aspiration up front as the motivation for our practice, that it be for the welfare and the happiness and the awakening of all beings. And so that provides this vast aspiration and a vast wellspring of energy for us to use in our practice. May our efforts and our practice be for the welfare, the benefit, the happiness, the awakening of all beings. Oh, thank you. It's going to be a great week.